Accession number 33891.
Reel 3.
Gary Arts, Reel 3. So can you tell me, Gary, how you started this process of learning to fly?
Well, we were flying tiger moths. Now, it was extremely cold. We were flying off snow, and what they had done, they packed the snow with rollers, made it firm, and then planted down the sides tops of bushes and trees that had just stuck in. So that was you saw the width of the runway. And the tiger moths were unlike those in the UK in that they had hoods. The normal tiger moth, the cockpit was open. And what they had done, they put hoods on these to make it a little warmer. So when you got into the airplane, you wore three lots of flying overalls. The first lot was a sort of silky material, rather thin. And the next was kapok lined to give you some sort of warmth. And then the one about last one was waterproof stuff. I was going to show you the picture. Forget. You also had a pair of silk gloves and a pair of gauntlets. Your head was covered by an ordinary leather helmet with hearing ear pads, a face mask, which was your microphone, but not a microphone, as I'll explain in a minute, and then a scarf around the face. You had to make sure every part of the skin was covered, nothing left to exposure for frostbite. And the feet, you had thick socks and flying boots which was made of suede and zipped up to almost to the knees.
Was that warm enough for the conditions?
It was warm enough, oh yes. I never felt, well, strangely enough, I'm one of these people who doesn't feel the cold very much, and I was quite comfortable. But things went very wrong, because after about three flights with various people, one of the aircraft crashed. And it was discovered, by chance, because two other aircrew came back, that these hoods on the tiger moth were being an embarrassment, in that the exhaust ran under the base of the aircraft, and somehow or other, the Venturio effect was bringing the gunge back into the cockpit, and the first aircraft had crashed because of lack of oxygen through carbon monoxide, so they took the hoods off. So you had to fly open cockpits with the temperatures ranging from anything between 20 and 30 below.
So what was the process then? How did they get you? You know, I take it you've not flown an aircraft before. So what is the first thing that they do when they introduce you to an aircraft?
Well, the first thing that they do is walk us round the aircraft and explain. And of course, with the Tiger Moth, you had to have to hand swing the propeller. So normally, if you were in the cockpit, the ground crew did that, but we had to train to do it ourselves on a just in case basis. And swinging a propeller with all that gear on was quite a thing. And of course, when you got into the aircraft with all that gear, you also had a parachute strapped on. And getting in and out was a bit cumbersome, I must admit.
So did they teach you a technique for swinging the propeller?
Oh yes, there was a definite technique of standing almost, balancing almost on on one leg as you gave the pull, so you could step back away from in case it kicked back. I know of nobody who ever got hurt with a kickback from the prop while I was there anyway.
So when did they introduce you, in a sense, then, to the aircraft and say, walk you around it to you what everything is?
Yes, walked us all the way around, and we had seen pictures of a cockpit, and they had the instruments explained to us what each one was supposed to do. But really, from then on, it was a case of being talked to through what was called the Gosforth tube. These aircraft had no intercom, normally, and contact from the aircraft to the ground was non-existent. There was no asking permission to land. You would do that a different way, which I'll explain later. But these Gosforth tubes were, in fact, the sort of things you used to see in the old houses, where you blew the whistle and spoke down the tube to the people down below. was exactly the same system. You didn't have a whistle, but you spoke into your face mask, which had a rubber tube, went forward to instructor in front, and he had the repeat and spoke to you, came into your hearing aid, which was very awkward anyway, because the voices weren't terribly clear. And after my very first trip, I was told by my instructor that he was going to have words with the education officer to see if I could have elocution lessons, because he found my Cockney accent a bit difficult to pick up on the end. And when I said, well, how about you, Sarge? Will you come? He was a sergeant. Will you come too? Because your Glaswegian accent's a bit strong. And he didn't appreciate that, but I could hardly understand him initially. And we got used to each other after a while. But, once you got into the cockpit, it was a case of talking you through what you were doing, right from the word go. Now you strap yourself in by... Now, put your feet, everything, step by step. Then, now we'll start the engines. We went through the starting up procedure and taxiing out. Now, taxiing out was always a difficult, because if you got off the hard part, you'd sink into the snow.
And taxiing a tiger moth, how do you do that?
Well, you just have to use your rudder to directionally control, a little extra engine and put on a bit of rudder. But most of the tracks were almost dead straight. It was fairly easy to start with.
So when you're taxiing out, are you slightly weaving?
Oh, yes, you're weaving. You have to, for it, because you can't see ahead. The slope of the aircraft means that the nose of the aircraft is above your eye level. So unless you sort of sit and peer around the side, you can't see where you're going. So you have to weave. You weave all the way up to the starting point. And then once you get onto the runway itself, it's a case of keeping it straight, as straight as you can, that is. And my first set of instructions were something like, right, now you're sitting on the edge of the runway, and we're going to do a takeoff. Now, ease the throttle through and let the engine warm up, make sure it's not oiled up at all. Now, take the brakes off, start to move it, that's right. Now, open up the throttle, and of course we were doing it. He was doing it, and I was doing it with him. And have to point out that in the between the wings and the struts, there was a mirror, so the instructor and I could see each other's faces, but that's about all. And off we went down the runway and eased the stick back, and that's right. Well, open your eyes, you bloody fool, and you'll see where you're going. That was my first set of instructions. We got on better after that.
Was it meant to be a familiar... Do you get a sort of familiarisation flight to start with?
Oh, yes.
To let you know about the local area?
It just to get just flew around a little and then started doing circuits and bumps. And there wasn't too much of circuits and bumps and no aerobatics initially. It was just... The only aerobatic we did during that first part of training was how to recover from a spin. But under the normal training that we're doing, circuits and bumps, as they're called, you wouldn't be high enough to get out of a spin anyway, but it was demonstrated.
So can you tell me about, obviously, with something like the Tiger Moth, which is a very different aircraft from the day when you have today, how do you control the Tiger Moth and do the most basic kind of manoeuvres?
It's all very much the same as it was when I was flying B-29s later, really, that you turned by putting your control stick, or in some cases wheel, to the left, and put a little left rudder on at the same time, and you controlled that by the amount of tilt you put on the wing. The more you tipped your wing, the faster you turned. And the intention initially was to always train us to do a rate one turn, as they called it. Now, you could tell you whether you were doing a rate one turn because one of the instruments did give you your angle of bank. It was a gyroscopic instrument which gave you the horizon, and the little gyroscopic aeroplane was floating around to give you your actual position. And a rate one turn done properly took exactly 2 minutes for what it's worth. And you learned all these basics. And the manoeuvre, the actual control of the aircraft through feet, rudder and aileron and what have you, is no different to what it was 10 years, 15 years later, as far as I was concerned.
So, but what you're getting there is the sense that you can actually, you have that sense of coordination to fly an aircraft,
and you have the feel. You begin to get the feel in your hands and in your feet and in your bum. Although that term, flying by the seat of the pants, is perhaps over-exaggerated. Later, when we started doing pure instrument flying, and they shut off, you covered up, you were really flying blind, and it did help. You could feel by the weight of your posterior whether you were leaning to the left or to the right. But you didn't have to rely on that very much.
But that's the sense, is it, of what you're learning there when you actually get into the air. That it's that sense of being able to control an aircraft.
And being the master of the machine. Making sure that right from the word go, you were the boss. And I had 9 hours and 20 minutes instruction. And then my instructor said, right, I'm going to put you up for a test. And the senior instructor took me up for 20 minutes. And he said, right, off you go. And I went solo 9 hours and 45 minutes after I started flying.
So that period, then you're allocated an instructor.
Mm.
And what does he do? Does he then take you up for that period?
He takes you all the time. We stay with the same instructor right the way through, right to the end of the course. And the same applied when we moved on to the next course. Same instructor all the time. And you got to know each other. I think each instructor had three pupils. So the basic system was that he would fire a couple of you in the morning. He might have had four, I'm not very sure. Fly a couple of you in the morning, in the afternoon you'd be on ground school. And then you take the other two who had been on ground school in the morning. And it was, the day was spent half flying, half on the ground, half flying, half on the ground.
So that early period then, prior to soloing, what are the things that you need to learn to do? And if you can take me through them, as I'm assuming that you have to take off, you have to
say the circuit. All the things, all the essentials were to start by making sure you kept your dead straight on the runway and to keep the aircraft straight. Now, if there is a slight crosswind, then you have to counteract that straight away. With a single-engined aircraft, it has to be done by the rudder. There are no brakes that you could apply. As you began to get the movement forward, the rudder became effective, and you kept straight by foot movements. Kept it straight, and you watch your speedometer until you realise you'd got flying speed, which I'm going here from memory, and I might be incorrect, with about 45, 50 miles an hour. Then you ease the stick back very gently until it lifted off the ground, and you held it like that until you climbed up to 1,000 feet. You never did any manoeuvres initially. When you did later in life, but initially you held it to 1,000 feet, and then it would be a turn to the left, always to the left, so that the airfield was always on the left, so that when you became multi-crewed, the captain always said on the left for the same reason. He could look down and see the runway. You'd go down, fly down the opposite way of the runway, and here you had a little light that you could flash, and you had to wait for a green light from the flying control to know that you could continue. Because if there were other aircraft, you'd get a red light, and then you would fly all the way round again until you got into the same position. But it was all done by flashing lights, no intercom, no radio contact. And then you'd fly out so that you were about, again and going from memory, maybe 4 miles away from the touchdown, and you start turning on. And you then have to control your speed so that you didn't drop the speed below the stalling speed, but at the same time could descend under control. And the whole time being aiming to land almost as soon as you could after you crossed the threshold of the runway. If you overshot, if you found you were too far down when you had, you just poured on the coals, as they say, and went on the way around again. I don't remember having to do that in the Tiger Moth. It was a very easy aircraft to fly, and because it had so few controls that you had to watch anyway, there was no problem.
With landing, is it, to a certain extent, is it your sensation of how high you are from the ground?
It is very much a sensation because, as I say, you can't see in front of you. You can tell from the position of the... I think it became an automatic judgment that you could see the land going past on your on the side, and so you held it into that landing position. The whole idea was always to make a three-point landing. Never, I mean, later on, wheeled landings were far better. My daughters are right.
And if it's, you know, because it's usually picking up just you on the microphone.
Right. So, as I say, you had the feel, you got to eventually into the position where you felt you got the right angle for that landing. So you were coming down in the landing position almost all the way to a three-point landing. If you came down too fast, of course, you bounced. That wasn't very good. And if you went off the runway, that was very poor. There's an amusing thing about... couple of chaps did go off, not the runway on landing, but off the taxi track, taxiing out, sank into the snow, and tried to get out by opening up the throttles, and of course, and the propeller went into the snow. And I think after two occasions, the senior flying instructor sent out an instruction, if you go off, you switch off and wait.
Now, you mentioned...
Well, may I finish this? There's the amusing point here. His name was Gosling, Flight Lieutenant Gosling. And about a week after he'd issued that instruction, he's dropped off the taxi track, got stuck in the snow, tried to get out by opening the throttles and tipped his nose up. So his aircraft had to come into the hangar to be repaired. And one of the airmen, or one of the trainee airmen, one of us, was a very good artist. And when Gosling went back to his aircraft, painted on the cowling was this picture of an ostrich with its head in the sand. He took it very well. He didn't have it removed. He left it there.
Can I ask as well, because obviously you would have to learn how to get out of a spin prior to soloing as well, would you? Could you turn me through the process of, you know, how you're instructed and how you actually get out of a spin?
Well, how to start? You go into a spin if the forward speed of the aircraft is such that there is an insufficient flow over the wings to maintain airworthiness. And normally, in most aircraft, one wing will drop automatically. And as it drops, you start sort of begin to almost turn over, and you go into a dive rotating. And the way to get out is to put opposite rudder on the direction of the spin and hold your stick forward. So the moment that opposite rudder takes effect and you're going into a direct dive, pull the stick back to come up again. And that's constant for most aircraft, but again, as you will learn later, after I left Tiger Moths, I never did aerobatics for another 20-odd years because everything I flew was non-aerobatic aircraft. So it was nice to know how to get out of it. In fact, maybe jumping ahead, the only other aircraft that I knew that could go into a spin was an Oxford. And you'll not believe this, but on the Oxford, there was between the two pilots and the door at the back, there was always a rope lying on the floor with knots. And the story was that if you went into a spin, you would never get out of it with an Oxford, you were to grab the rope, climb up it to the door and get out. I don't know of anybody who ever did it, but that's what you were supposed to do with the airspeed Oxford. Anyway, after going off solo, then we got into the more exciting stuff of aerobatics.
Could I just ask a little bit about that soloing again? What kind of, again, the process is for you going off on your own?
Well, we got to 1,000 feet. I turned to the right to do this business of keeping the runway on my left, flashed my lights, and all the time I'm watching. I mean, you had got used to the position that your throttle should be to give you the speed you required to maintain stability. And you just have to watch against your wings against the horizon. Later on, of course, when instrument flying, you flew on the instrument. And you watched your wings against the horizon to make sure you weren't, you know, doing this or anything, until you got to the point you wanted to turn. You then left rudder a little and left wing down a little, do the turn to do a 180 degree down, go back holding your speed all the time, again at the other end until you had turned onto the runway. And once you've done that, it was throttled back slightly to start coming down. And again, once you'd been with the instructor a few times and done it with him, you knew roughly the position of the throttle to give you the speed you wanted to drop off. And I think it's correct to say that in time, you did it almost automatically. I mean, that first one, I don't remember being scared. I don't remember even being concerned. I thought, done this before with him sitting up front, what's the difference? The aircraft's lighter, and that's about all. And you have a slightly better vantage point that you don't see the back of his head. Not seeing the back of his head was helpful. Still, we did that.
How did you feel, obviously, having solo? Because I'm assuming it was a great feeling.
I mean, we were all fighting each other to be the first to go solo. I wasn't the first. I think I was among the lowest in the hours required. I don't know how long people take now to go solo, but I believe later on at Cranwell it was many hours. But anyway.
And would there be a point where if somebody hadn't soloed by a certain time, they wouldn't continue on the course?
That's where we lost our first. My particular buddy, the chap from Devon, didn't make it. He just could not coordinate landing. And he left the course. He was the first of the odd 60 that started. He was the first to depart. And he was sent off to gunnery school.
And was it the case that landing tended to be the problem for most people?
The coordination of landing was the point that gave most people the trouble. There's no doubt about that. Although later, of course, when you started aerobatics, getting the right sort of, shall we say, pitch and toss of the aircraft to do a proper aerobatic, I think must have put some people out. I don't know, because nobody else, as I recall, left on that first course. We lost more on the next stage. But I think once you started aerobatics, and once you'd done it several times and you got that confidence of throwing the aircraft into a spin deliberately to get out of it, it became almost natural. And I can well imagine many pilots who have done it once or twice feeling, well, there's nothing to it. I never got too easy. Jumping many years ahead, I was adjutant at Royal Air Force College, and the first time I flew an aerobatic aircraft again was the Vampire, when I did my 50 hours flying. And at the end of the period, I was presented with the only pilot who could transmit aileron flutter through from the control column. According to my instructor, he thought I was shaking like a devil. But then I'd got about 2,000 plus hours in my logbook, and I'd never been upside down since I left the Tiger Moth. That's the way it happened. Still, I'm jumping ahead there.
So after soloing, how does the course progress? What are the things that they start to introduce then?
Only the aerobatics. Only the ability to take off, fly, do the aerobatics properly, and pass the odd ground test that you were given. Once you pass through that, we all, en masse, the whole 59 of us, I think I may be a little wrong in that, but I think it was the 59 of us moved on to the next school.
So can I ask about the aerobatics that you can carry out in a Tiger Moth, and what you're expected to do?
I roll, a loop, to roll off the top of a loop. No, you start the loop and then instead of going on, come back up again. I really cannot remember other than that. The loop, the spin, the roll off, and the roll off the top of the loop.
Can you tell me with those then, obviously with something like the loop, how do you carry out a loop? What are you trying to achieve, and how do you do it in a Tiger Moth?
Well, it's really, I suppose, you must remember you're speaking to somebody who's not terribly aerobatic expert, but as I recall, it was very much a case of you put the aircraft, you had to be at height obviously to start with, and you put your aircraft into a dive at full throttle to build up as much speed as possible, and you kept the throttle on until you went up to the top, and then you could ease the throttle back because you were now going to go descend and you're going into more or less into a gliding turn, shall we say. and opened up the throttles as you began to level off again. With the roll, it was a case of gain, as I recall, building up as much speed as one could in the horizontal position, and then swinging over as hard as you could to take the aircraft, retake completely. And the weight on the shoulders, as I remember, with the parachute strapped on your bum as well, was always a bit overpowering, because you feel you were leaving the aircraft in some position. It was a bit uncomfortable. I don't know that I didn't enjoy aerobatics, but I didn't miss them when I no longer did them, I must admit. I became very much a heavies man.
And with the Tiger Moth, can you sort of give me a thumbnail sketch of it as an aircraft?
Well, now it's very difficult. In length, I would imagine 30 feet, wingspan, two wings, about the same, two cockpits, one behind the other, the instructor in the front, the pupil at the back, canvas framework, and I don't even remember what sort of engine was it in.
How did it handle?
Beautifully. It was a lovely aircraft to fly. There's still some flying now, but no, it was a very nice aircraft. I thoroughly enjoyed flying the Tiger Moth. In fact, I don't think there's any aircraft I didn't enjoy flying in over the period, except perhaps the Vampire.
And what colour were the aircraft?
Oh, they were the normal sort of yellowy, khaki, a light khaki colour with RAF rounders on. I haven't got any coloured pictures. All my pictures, of course, in those days were black and white.
And can I ask, obviously, about the sensation of you landing on snow and operating on snow? Was it very different?
Of course, had no previous experience, but when I found myself landing on runways, I realised how much easier it was. There was always the scare of landing on the snow, of going into a skid, because if you went, there's nothing you could do about it. Nobody ever did, that I know of. And I think here the air traffic control and the senior flying instructor were very close cooperation to make sure that we never flew with an excessive crosswind. Because, once an aircraft is in the air, it is subject to the air movement. Example, if you're sitting at the end of a runway and the wind is blowing straight down the runway at 30 miles an hour, your airspeed indicator reads 30 miles an hour and you're not moving. Now, the same applies if the wind's coming from the side. You're moving that much to the side the moment you leave the ground. And so I think they concentrated making sure that our flying was done where the wind was negligible or dead straight down the runway.
And
in the prairies, I think that's fairly constant.
And they got you to a stage then, really, to be able to handle that aircraft on your own to a certain ability.
You were told to go off and do aerobatics on your own, which I did. You were told to go and do a cross-country, which I did. That is, to fly from one point to another, and sort of keep a log of where you turned.